In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is easy to take the crossword puzzle for granted. It's a ubiquitous part of every newspaper, many magazines. Online puzzles are easy to find, and you can usually pick up a collection in the checkout line at the grocery store. Puzzle fanatics, of course, have a much more intense relationship with these grids. But even a puzzle fanatic will learn something new and surprising from Adrian Raffel's book, Thinking Inside the Box, Adventures with Crosswords and the Puzzling People Who Can't Live Without Them. Raffel has an MFA in poetry from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. The book is out in paperback, and she'll be doing a virtual event at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City Tuesday evening, tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. Hello, Adrian.
Hi, Charity. It's so good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I want to go back in time and learn a little bit about you. When did you become interested in crossword puzzles?
Well, I think I've been interested in word puzzles and word games since before I can remember. Like, I sort of, my like first memories and learning how to read all kind of coincide with each other. I always loved like letters and games, but I got interested in crossword puzzles. I started doing them really in high school. My family would do them. We're a very sort of games-oriented family, I'll say. We were like very always kind of, my dad would turn everything into games, and we would compete against each other with the crossword puzzles. But I've always been kind of interested in words, and then that morphed into crosswords. But I really got fascinated by them as a cultural thing, as a thing in the world, for a couple of reasons. I just started realizing that, you know, it's this thing that millions and millions of people do every day, or don't do, or hate doing, or love doing, or sort of indifferent to and see, but it's always kind of there, right? So it's always there. And then I realized, wait, crosswords also started at the same time as modernist literature. So you have, you know, T.S. Eliot, and you have Virginia Woolf, and you have the crossword puzzles. Like, whoa, there is something cool going on here. So, it sort of really morphed from this personal, how can I compete with my family, to cultural, like, what is this thing that everybody's kind of got going on in the world, to then when I started learning more about it, the literary history, the artistic history. It hit every note of all. It was like, oh, this thing is really just continues to be more and more fascinating.
Well, and I already mentioned your MFA in poetry, so this is not the most, I guess, predictable thing for you to do with an MFA in poetry. But I was thinking about crosswords and sort of the symmetry and the beauty of them, thinking about the crypticness of those clues. Do you feel like there's a relationship between crosswords and poetry?
I definitely do. I think there's something so amazing too in that crosswords ask you to think of every kind of relationship between the clue and the answer. And I've also, as a poet and as a person, I'm really interested in riddles and nonsense verse too, and the ways that, you know, you can say something that seems really straightforward, but actually they want you to go in completely the opposite direction, right? So crosswords, I find so fascinating because they make your brain do everything. They make your brain think about, my favorite example of this is, how do you clue the same word easier or harder? So if you have the word bacon, right, you can think of like fried pork thing for breakfast. So that's a really easy clue for bacon. But then if you think about, like, I don't know, cash money, that's a sort of more difficult clue for bacon, but it's still straightforward, bringing home the bacon. And then my favorite clue for bacon is, like, strips in a club with a question mark, maybe. And you think strips in a club, you're thinking of the verb to strip in a nightclub. And then you realize, no, it's strips as a noun in a club sandwich. And that's bacon. So I think there's so I forget who came up with that clue. But yeah, that kind of relationship between what goes on in the grid and what goes on for your mind to all the different kinds of associations your mind has to do, and whether, and they can be so idiosyncratic. So I love that about crosswords.
In the book, you share a story about being at a writer's retreat, and you had a month at this writer's retreat. And I can imagine that probably there was an expectation of, I don't know, writing poetry or writing something else. And this is when you decided to create your first crossword puzzle. And it pretty much took you the month, right?
You know, I I was there to work on this book, you know, so at least there was that kind of justification. But, you know, it really is great. I'm really good at getting stuff done that I'm not supposed to be doing. So
I think that's the epitome of what this is all about. So go on, though.
No, exactly. And I think that's the secret thesis of the book. It's like, crosswords will help you do the things that you're not supposed to be, or you can feel great about doing them, right? So it was this, like, meta moment of, okay, I you know, I had all this, I had mapped out, okay, I'm going to, you know, draft out this chapter and this chapter. And I thought, okay, well, I need to, you know, I'll take an afternoon and just, like, you know, as a break, I'll see what it's like, as a constructive break, I'll see what it's like to construct a crossword puzzle. Shouldn't take me more than, you know, the day. And it took so long. And I had to throw stuff out. It was, I'm really glad I did it. It was, like, one of the most eye-opening parts of the process. But it was incredible, just the amount of finicky labor, and actually, like, really, like, you know, the puzzling work that goes into constructing a crossword puzzle.
Well, before we get into that work, because we will talk about that, you've learned a great deal about that, let's dig into the history of the crossword puzzle, which is also fascinating and serendipitous and kind of bizarre. But it first was created back in 1913. Tell me how it came about.
And this was a surprising fact to me, Charity, because I thought that the crossword, oh, it's been around for centuries, right? Millennia. Like, you know, people have been playing with words and word games for so long. I was surprised to find out that it's as recent as 1913. And of course, there are word games and puzzles that have been around for centuries. The ancestors of the crossword have been around, but the specific technology, this editor at a newspaper called the New York World, so the editor's name is Arthur Wynn, and he edits the fun supplement, you know, like the entertainment supplement with all the cartoons and puzzles, and they want him to do a bigger supplement around Christmas time. And Arthur Wynn is like, oh my gosh, I need to fill this. I need to fill, like, you know, more pages in this supplement. What am I going to do? And so he thinks, well, and technology had kind of recently made it cheaper and more available to print grids, blank grids onto the page. He's like, great, a blank grid. That takes up a bunch of space. Amazing. Perfect. Love it. And then he's like, well, how can I justify this? Oh, I can have clues to fill in answers to this blank grid. He prints it. It's actually kind of a diamond shape at first, and it eventually got flipped into a square. He calls it a word cross puzzle. And then a few weeks later, some typesetter accidentally sets the title as a crossword rather than a word cross. That sticks. But yeah, so it was an invention out of desperation, and then people loved it. And Arthur Wynn went from editing the fun supplement and a bunch of other things to quickly becoming the New York World's crossword editor.
Well, and it wasn't a job that he necessarily took very seriously. He wasn't very careful about it. I I can just imagine modern crossword puzzlers being horrified to learn about the inattention to detail that that puzzle was given for the first years of its life.
And, you know, puzzlers at the time were just as detail-oriented and just as furious. They'd write these irate letters to Arthur Wynne, who didn't, he at a certain point, he was phoning it in. He said, you know, I just, whatever I print, people will love it. And so
they send angry letters, both.
And they'll do it. I guess the point is, like, it'll make money for the newspaper. Eventually, though, the New York World was like, we have to stop this. And they put this brand new secretary they just hired. They assigned her to the crossword desk. And she was not too happy about this either. She's an ambitious secretary. She wants to be a writer. She wants to make her way in the world, but in the newspaper world. But then she realized, wait, this crossword could be way better and I could be way better with it. And her name is Margaret Farrer. And Margaret Farrer is sort of the grand dame of the crossword. She went from this reluctant position to really taking it over. She eventually became the first crossword editor at the New York Times. She standardized a lot of the conventions that have made crosswords really the, like, fun game that they are today. So it was, you know, Arthur Wynne kind of abandoned his invention, but luckily we had Margaret Farrer to come take up the mantle for us.
And he never even managed to trademark the name crossword either.
No. Well, I love this. He tried to get the New York World to pay for the trademark some moderate sum of money that was like not that much. And they said, well, no, we can't do that. So just to think.
Yeah, I mean, there was a gold mine there that he did not get a chance to tap into at all. We are going to take a short break. I'm talking with Adrian Raffel, author of Thinking Inside the Box, Adventures with Crosswords and Puzzling People Who Can't Live Without Them. The book is out in paperback, and she'll be doing a virtual event at Prairie Lights Bookstore tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. And while we're talking about books, the March Talk of Iowa Book Club is coming up on the air on Tuesday, March 23rd. This month, we're reading The Overstory by Richard Powers, and there's still time to read if you get going now. You can also subscribe to the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. Iowa Public Radio News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Hear First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters, learn about what's going on at the Statehouse and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Hear First today wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Adrian Raffel, author of Thinking Inside the Box, Adventures with Crosswords and the Puzzling People Who Can't Live Without Them. The book is out in paperback, and she'll be doing a virtual event at Prairie Lights Bookstore tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. The crossword puzzle became something that was respectable, something that was organized, something that was detail-oriented. But it still hadn't taken over the world. But there's a publishing company that really helped launch it into this massive thing that it is. And it also is the beginning of the publishing company, which we know as Simon & Schuster. This was the very first thing they published, was a collection of crossword puzzles?
And yeah, I find this is so amazing. This is a sort of sidebar in the history of the crossword puzzle. That's not actually a sidebar. It's really integral to it, the crossword. So Simon & Schuster, original Simon & Schuster, they want to form a publishing company. And one of their aunts, Aunt Wixie, I think is her actual name, says, I love crosswords, or, you know, I really wish there was a volume of crossword puzzles. And they're like, well, gosh, if we do this, what if it's just a total failure? We're a serious publisher. We want to be a serious publishing company. So they publish a volume of crosswords under the imprint Plaza Publishing, just sort of a made-up imprint. I find this so great. They're like, oh, yeah, they haven't done anything yet. But they're like, but you know, we don't want to put Simon & Schuster on this. We want our first, yeah.
So, but it turned into a gold mine for them and something that they still do, right?
Oh, crossword puzzles have been in print with Simon & Schuster since the very beginning. Yeah, they're still a gold mine for them. I mean, the first run of the crossword puzzle book sold over 100,000 copies basically overnight. Then the second run sold even more than that. The third run, like it's, yeah, it's huge by today's publishing standards, little, you know, in the 1920s, enormous.
Right. Well, let's talk about the New York Times, because of course, that when people think about crossword puzzles, at least in the United States now, the New York Times is the first organization that comes to mind. They are the gold standard for the crossword puzzle. When did the New York Times start publishing a crossword?
The New York Times didn't get in the game until 1942. And so in the 1920s, right when Simon & Schuster first published their collection and newspapers are really taking up the crossword mantle, the crossword is a huge craze. It's a huge fad in the U.S., also in England. But but the New York Times publishes these editorials saying, well, you know, basically poo-pooing the crossword. Like, we are a serious newspaper. Our readers want serious news, and we don't have to pander to them. Eventually, though, World War II actually is what drove the New York Times to publish a crossword puzzle. Right after Pearl Harbor, one of the editors sent a memo to the publisher and said, you know, I know we're a serious newspaper, but look, the world is bleak. Our headlines are bleak. We need something. We need to give our readers a balm, something that they can, you know, really enjoy, like a gift to our readers. And the publisher, as it turns out, actually secretly loved crosswords. He was like buying his competitors' newspapers on the sly just to do their crosswords. So he was like, okay, twist my arm. But if we're going to have a crossword, we're the New York Times, we're going to have the best crossword in the land. And so that's why, as I mentioned earlier, that's why he hired Margaret Farrer, who had been the one who was editing all these Simon & Schuster collections. So she'd spent, you know, she was not only the New York World's editor, she spent like the past 20, you know, almost 20 years editing the Simon & Schuster collection. So she's made a name for herself as the crossword editor. They hire her and publish their serious crossword.
Well, you mentioned that heyday in the 1920s, and one of the things that kind of stood out to me from your description of that time, I mean, people were crazy for the crossword and wearing dresses with grids on them and, you know, doing all kinds of stuff and the kind of things that we do now when we go crazy for something. But also, the crossword was driving sales of the dictionary. And crossword puzzlers have kind of a complicated relationship with the dictionary because you're not really supposed to look things up, right?
Well, and this is great. And it was driving sales of the dictionary. It was libraries were complaining because people were having like a run on the dictionaries and the encyclopedias in the library. But you're right. On the flip side, is looking things up in the crossword, is that cheating? Is that what, you know, like how kosher is that? Deb Amlin, who writes a blog at the New York Times, she writes their wordplay column rather. She's like sort of the chief crossword writer at the Times. I like what she says about this, though. She's like, well, I don't consider it cheating. If you look it up, you know, it's your crossword. You bought it, you paid for it. Like if cheating or if looking things up helps you enjoy it more, then great. And I will say, you know, like I look things up. I think that part of the beauty of the crossword is you get to learn things. And so, you know, like I get to discover things and then maybe I try not to look that up the next time.
So, of course, these days people do not carry around pocket-sized dictionaries, but we all have a computer in our pockets. So are you also saying that it's okay for me to put a clue into a search engine?
Well, Jared, I give you full permission to do that, unless you're in like the middle of a crossword tournament where somebody might, you know, slap you on the wrist. I say, I don't know, yourself, even, you know, if you're playing the puzzle on your phone, go to the tab and look it up. I try to draw the line at sites that are like
nytimescrosswordanswers.com if I find myself. Those exist.
Oh, funny. So as long as I can still look myself in the eye, it's okay for me.
Exactly.
To get a little bit of help.
As long as you can keep your dignity intact.
Well, let's talk about the modern New York Times puzzle. Of course, public radio listeners have a close relationship with Will Shortz, the puzzle master of the New York Times. And you get up close and personal with Will Shortz, the other people who help him edit the puzzle and really help us understand that process. So lay that out for us just briefly. How does that work? Will Shortz does not write all of those puzzles, although he does write some puzzles. But people from all over the country and probably around the world are sending him puzzles all the time, right?
Exactly. Will Shortz edits the puzzle. This is and people ask me this, yeah, like, how does Will Shortz write all those puzzles? And the answer is he doesn't. Every puzzle gets sent in to the New York Times. It used to be sent in by mail. During the pandemic, they really shifted to, you can finally now email your crossword puzzle to the New York Times. It used to be this very, paper mail process. Now you can email it. But, it's all a freelance model, essentially. People, there are more regular constructors, you know, you get to know somebody's name, but anybody in the world can send their puzzle to Shortz, and Shortz works with a couple of assistant editors, and they go through every submission. They really go through every submission. Even if there's a backlog, they'll go through them all. And the main thing they're looking for is primarily, does your grid work? You know, they crossword editors, a lot of their work ends up being changing the way that words are clued, but that's easier to do than changing the letters in the grid, right? Because you change one letter and the entire grid falls apart. So they're really looking for grids they haven't seen before, cool themes or like clever words. They're looking for that kind of thing. And they're also looking to publish new constructors. So if anybody out there, and I know they've gotten an uptick of submissions since the pandemic, which is cool. Yeah. So they go through, so at least two editors get their eyes on every single submission, and they make sure that they give feedback to everybody who submits. And you know, if it's a no, they'll try to give some encouragement of like, okay, well, you know, we've seen this theme that are puns on breakfast foods. We've seen that 10,000 times. But we like your idea of doing puns, so try doing that. Or, you know, they'll say something, brief but really helpful when they get back to you, hopefully. So like it takes a while for them, I know, but I know also they're really excited to see more and more constructors coming through the pipeline.
Yeah, it's really interesting to read about that process. And one of the things that you point out in that process, though, that has been a problem for the New York Times, and it's a problem for crosswords generally, is that at the time when you're writing about how they're reading all of these and editing these puzzles, it's three white guys sitting in a house together reading all of these puzzles. You really feel like there's a real diversity problem in the puzzle world. Tell me more about that.
And you know what's actually been really interesting is, you know, it's not me. The puzzle world has noticed, and the New York Times has noticed. They've actually hired more readers from more diverse backgrounds, more test solvers. And so the puzzle world is taking note, because overwhelmingly so let's say in the 20th century, right? So let's like before the 21st century, in the 20th century, the crossword puzzle is sort of overwhelmingly culturally upper class white men who went to Yale. Like that's the audience for the crossword puzzle. And a lot of solvers, the solvers were sort of equally men and women, but the constructors are really, it's white male dominated. Editorships are tended to be white male dominated. But the crossword world really began to notice. And the crossword itself, there's many more, the clues and answers are being written radically differently rather than just kind of catering to a very specific cultural niche. They're really bringing in lots of different cultural references, really opening up the world within the crossword puzzle. And there's also really, really active efforts to encourage constructors from all over age, race, gender, just like all, you know, everywhere. We're encouraging people to submit. There's more and encouraging more people to edit crosswords. Like there's been, expert constructors are actively mentoring people. There's been a real push for that, and it's filtered up to the New York Times as well. They're aware.
So change is happening. Crosswords are reflecting more of the world, more of the world that we actually live in. How about crossword puzzle competitions? What do those look like?
So crossword puzzle competitions, you know, I love them. They are just like this crazy cross between like the Super Bowl and the SATs.
You know, it's like as people are super jazzed, super competitive, like wearing all their team crossword jersey stuff. And then what's the activity? You're in a room and sort of basically like little cubicles, like filling in letters on the page. Like that's the activity. And yet people are so jazzed for this. They're really fun. During the pandemic, crossword tournaments shifted online pretty quickly and actually pretty well. Like there's been a lot of these kind of virtual events and the crossword community has really gotten behind them. The biggest crossword tournament every year is called the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament. It's held in Stamford, Connecticut. Normally, last year was canceled, but then it was beautiful. An online tournament like sprung up the weekend it should have been, you know, and it was like they got 1,000 people. This year, they're doing the event virtually. But yeah, crossword tournaments are really just the place to go if you want to understand or even like try to understand why people love this game so much.
Why do people love this game so much?
You know, I think there's the one answer, you know, people who are just really the crossword community has become their world, and crosswords are the thing that they do. They do like 7 or 8 crosswords a day. They're active on Twitter. There's that kind of the subculture of crosswords. So there's that answer. But I think for the broader answer, for millions of people for whom the crossword is a part of their day, it's both a thing that's an escape from the day. It's something you can control. It's something that you know you can like get into a rage, but also triumph over. You know the emotions that are going to be there. And also something that, you know, I realized before the pandemic, but really crystallized for me during this time was just how social crosswords are. It seems kind of paradoxical, right? You're just in your own little isolated bubble doing the crossword. But actually, you know, you talk to people about the crossword. You can, on your phone, you can see how fast you've solved it. So you can compete with your friends. You can talk to people about clues that have stumped you. If you, you know, it can be sort of awkward and hard to just talk to people with nothing at all. But if you've got a crossword in front of you and you're, you know, looking at the clues, then that clue will spark some other kind of form of conversation. Or it's just a real way, you know, crosswords are really part of the world. They connect to every kind of subject matter. There's something there for everyone. And so I found crosswords, I think they're great as an individual activity, but I think they're really special as this social thing that, you know, I can be looking at a newspaper, my phone, a magazine here, and then somebody a million miles away is looking at the same thing.
Why do you think the crossword puzzle seems to outshine all other word puzzles? I'm sure there's, you know, somebody who would take issue with that. But I think that it is true. I mean, there are other word puzzles out there, but the crossword stands out above them all.
Well, I have to say, you know, biasly, my favorite word puzzle is actually boggle, which is like a much, so I you know, my just to play, just surely, I love it. It's just so simple, but I love forming the letters in boggle. But I think the crossword has stuck, it really has become this really special thing in society because it does have that content, it's got themes, it's got cleverness. Crosswords are one of the few games out there. I think right now it's like crosswords and bridge, but crosswords are one of the few games out there that humans are still better than AI at solving. There's something that's really great about how crosswords can also kind of take the unique stamp of their creator, their editor. And, you know, on the one hand, they are a game, but they also have so much personality, connect to the world, and I think really hit that sweet spot in a way that other games just can't.
Adrian, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.
Adrian Raffel. The book is Thinking Inside the Box, Adventures with Crosswords and the Puzzling People Who Can't Live Without Them. And she'll be doing a virtual event at Prairie Lights Bookstore tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.